The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is titled Inside America's Suicide Crisis. After surviving a suicide attempt at age 23, Desiree's stage felt profound loneliness. I was too ashamed to talk about it, she says. In the few survivor stories I found, the person was anonymous and everything was tied up in a bow at the end. In 2010, Stage launched Live Through This, a site where survivors share their experiences. She says no two stories are alike. Some people have had long mental health struggles. Some had, quote-unquote, normal childhoods. Suicide isn't about the, quote-unquote, crazy person. It's about all of us. Though headlines about rising murder rates may quicken our pulses, an American is more likely to take her own life than be killed by someone else. In 2016, there were more than twice as many suicides, 44,965, as homicides, 19,362, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. We can't be quiet about this anymore, says suicidologist Julie Correll, Ph.D., a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Social Work and president of the American Association of Suicidology. Each loss increases the risk for the entire community, as people who are close to someone who dies by suicide are more likely to then have suicidal thoughts themselves. When we hear a person has ended her life, whether she's a friend or a public figure, the question is the same. Why? Even experts can't explain what drives certain people to suicide. Compared with other leading causes of death, suicide research is not well-funded, says Correll. Furthermore, suicidal behavior can't be replicated in a lab. Subjects may be reluctant to report suicidal thoughts, and each individual is influenced by a complex combination of variables, which may include depression, substance abuse, genetics, and negative life circumstances. Even if we're certain we'll never reach the point of ultimate despair, anyone around us could be vulnerable. We must stay alert to each other's suffering, says Alan Ross, executive director of the Samaritans of New York, which runs a crisis response hotline. Suicide prevention is not about death, it's about life, how we help people in their time of need. Sharon Greenwald, 55, New York City, attempted suicide in 2016. I never considered that I felt worthless because I was depressed. I thought I felt depressed because I was worthless. My marriage had ended. Then 5 years later, I was living alone in the city. My son stayed in the suburbs with my ex-husband, and my daughter was away at college. Losing my old identity and routine was terrifying. I'd sit in my apartment and think, "You're never going to have a life again." Since I was a teenager, I'd had this feeling that I deserved to be punished. When the pain got to be too much, I told myself I would end it. Meanwhile, I lived like a person without a future. I didn't paint over my ugly brown walls. Why bother? I loved dogs, but I wouldn't adopt one. I wasn't going to be around to take care of it. It didn't occur to me that I might have clinical depression, because I wasn't sad 24/7. I was happy at work, and when I was with my kids. I went to the Cayman Islands with friends. How could I be depressed? For 10 years, I'd been planning to die. Then right before the weekend of July 4th, I thought, that's it. There's no way in hell I'm going through another holiday alone. I tied up loose ends at work, returned my company laptop. I labeled all my jewelry because I wanted my daughter to know the story behind every piece. I made a list of passwords for my ex-husband, who was the executor of my will. I texted my kids that I love them. I was looking forward to dying. I thought, I'm going to see my father again. I left notes for everyone, including one apologizing to whoever found me. Consider it, right? Then I swallowed a large quantity of pills and said, "Dad, I'll be there soon." When I didn't show up at the office, my coworkers contacted my daughter, who called my doorman. I was rushed to the hospital, where I spent a week in a coma. The doctors weren't sure I would ever wake up. My family stayed at my bedside talking to me and playing Bruce Springsteen, my favorite. But I wasn't aware of it. The first thing I did hear was my mother's voice telling me where I was. Then I remembered what had happened, and I was so sorry. When the doctor said, "You've obviously been very depressed," it was a revelation. I hadn't realized how distorted my thoughts had become. My daughter asked me later, "How could you do this to us?" But that's how screwed up I was. I didn't think my kids would miss me. I thought they'd be sad at the funeral and then they'd go on with their lives. A suicidal person isn't thinking about abandoning her loved ones. She just wants to end the pain. I get pissed off whenever somebody says, "He had $1 billion. Why would he do this?" He did it because he was in pain too. As it turns out, depression runs in my family, but nobody had ever talked about it. I'm very serious about taking meds, going to therapy, practicing the mindfulness skills I've learned. I feel like I've gotten a second chance. It's funny, a few months after I got out of the hospital, I was hit by a taxi. And I was lying there in the street thinking, "Are you serious? This is happening now when I want to live?" Fortunately, I just broke my foot. I finally painted my walls a beautiful cream and light green and got a rug in fun 60s colors. I got a dog. When I look at her lying with her little paws up in the air, it's a small thing, but it makes me so happy. That's what mindfulness has taught me. I feel my chest rising and falling, and I try to enjoy the now, because the now is where I am. Ann Taylor, 55, Los Angeles, attempted suicide in 2009 and 2012. Within a period of 18 months, both of my parents passed away, and my husband asked for a divorce. Any one of those things I could have dealt with, but not altogether. I thought, "You're alone in the world." I'd never been diagnosed with any mental health issues besides some postpartum depression with one of my sons. But now all I wanted was to stop the pain. I'd lost the three people who had always had my back. I was visiting a friend who lived nearby and told her I thought I needed to check myself into a psychiatric hospital. She said she'd drive me, and I went back to my house to pack. But once I was home alone, I was so overwhelmed by anxiety that I didn't think I could live through another second. So I took every pill I could find and drank a bunch of alcohol. It was that spontaneous. I got a lot of therapy. At the time, the only other people who knew about my attempt were my ex-husband, who had to take care of the kids, and the friend who was going to drive me to the hospital, as well as her husband. She eventually disappeared from my life. She said, "Every time I hear an ambulance, I worry it's headed to your house. How do you think that feels?" For me, that first attempt was like crossing a line. 3 years later, I attempted again when I was going through a breakup and my emotions were out of control. After I got home from the hospital, I hid for fear someone would ask what had happened. But after a year or so, I couldn't keep it a secret anymore. I started to tell people, and most were supportive. But this is a very difficult subject for friends and family to talk about. I also started going to a support group for attempt survivors that was facilitated by a therapist, as well as someone who's a survivor themselves. Just to sit with other people and get the words out of my mouth, "I have attempted suicide," was such a relief. I became a peer facilitator, and I also volunteer on the crisis hotline. I think many people have suicidal thoughts at some point in their life, yet don't want to talk about it because they're trying to protect themselves. But bringing dark thoughts into the light lessens their power. Kelechi Obuzo, 33, Oakland, attempted suicide in 2009. People say suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, but some problems are, in fact, permanent. My grandmother died when I was 14, and I took it really hard. She was a wonderful person who loved even the darkest parts of me. After she was gone, I told a friend I wanted to die too. She told a teacher, who told my mom, and I ended up in the hospital. I never wanted to go back, so I stuffed my feelings down and pretended to be the happiest, most glittery unicorn. In my 20s, I was still pretending, but inside, my brain was a tornado. I was trying to realize my dream of being a journalist, but I needed two other jobs to make ends meet. I felt like I was failing everyone's expectations, including my own. I thought, you don't deserve to be here. I was feeling increasingly desperate, so I went to the hospital. They told me, you're not sick enough to be here. You're too high functioning. Maybe they were understaffed and could only take the highest risk cases. Maybe they weren't taking me seriously because I'm a black woman who presented too well. Anyway, I didn't know how to prove I was in serious trouble, and they let me go. A few weeks after that, I was raped by someone I knew. Something lit up inside me, like, I've got to get out, way out, so he can't do this again. I wrote my roommates a rent check and drove to a hotel far away. I don't want to get into the details of what happened next. My mom, who's a doctor, helped me get into one of the top outpatient facilities in Georgia where she was living. The staff there was amazing. They helped me stop pretending I was okay all the time. My therapist and I did trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, and I learned to look at my thoughts, slow them down, and stop them. I'd say, no one cares about me. She'd say, is that true? What about your mom? I was very lucky. My mental health was my full-time job. Am I happy now? Well, I'm healthy. I've learned to recognize the difference, and I'm honest about it with people that I love. When I feel like I'm starting to slip, I don't mess around. Now I have a great support network. A few years ago, I had a situation. I'd called off an engagement, the negative thoughts had come flooding back, and the man who raped me tried to get in touch with me. So I put myself first. I took a month off from my job, checked into an intensive outpatient program, asked my mom to come stay with me, and dealt with my mental health. During that time, a friend did the most beautiful thing. For every one of the 30 days I took off, she gave me a gift. A chocolate, a superhero comic book, a quote. I got through it and went back to work. Stacy Friedenthal, 51, Denver, attempted suicide in 1996. I once read that we all have a prosecutor in our head who points out the things we've done wrong, but we don't all have a strong defense attorney. Mine had gone missing entirely. I'd wake up at 3 a.m. and lie there thinking of all the ways I was defective. It could be the smallest thing, like my dirty floors. My psychiatrist wanted me to go back on medication, which I'd stopped because I had hair loss, an uncommon side effect. I just thought medication won't work. I knew all about distorted thinking. I was studying to be a therapist, and I'd even volunteered at a suicide hotline. But that's what depression does. It lies. I wrote a letter to my parents apologizing and assuring them they'd be better off without me. Then I put up a sign for the friends who had keys to my place at eye level so they wouldn't miss it. Do not go into my room. To spare yourself, call 911. I'm so sorry. I thought asphyxiation would be peaceful, but the body fights back. I began gasping for air as everything was going black. Instinctively, I began struggling to free myself, panicked that I would pass out before I managed to abort the attempt. It was terrifying, but also a relief to be connected to the survival instinct. There's a theory that when a person is contemplating self-harm or suicide, she's in a dissociative state, as if she's outside her own body. Then at the moment when her life is in peril, the survival instinct kicks in and she snaps back. It's almost like thinking, oh my God, my mind is trying to murder me. Sometimes when people take pills and then call for help, their suicide attempt isn't considered serious. I believe every attempt is serious. I also believe that in many cases, they probably had what mental health professionals call a high intent to die. It's just that at the crucial moment, their survival instinct kicked in. This is why firearms are especially dangerous. They're instantaneous. The person never has the chance to feel that survival impulse. For years, whenever anyone asked why I focused on suicide in my work as a therapist, I gave them the partial truth, telling them a friend of mine had killed himself in high school and I wanted to help people like him. But the longer I hid, the more hypocritical I felt. So in 2017, I finally came out of the closet. I've since received so many letters from people who work in mental health, from graduate students to therapists who were in their 80s, who themselves had thought about or attempted suicide, yet never felt they could confide in anybody. I hope that can change as we diminish the stigma of suicide. Stigma means a mark of disgrace. and I refused to abide by the notion that anyone with suicide, depression, or other mental health problems deserves a mark of disgrace. Anita Wilson, 53, New Albany, Ohio, attempted suicide in 2012. Well-meaning Christians will say, if you're depressed, you should just pray more. Mental health issues can be taboo in the church because asking for help feels like shining a spotlight on your spiritual life and admitting that your faith isn't strong enough. When I began struggling with depression as a young woman, I didn't tell my pastor or congregation. I managed my condition with medication, but then in my late 30s, chronic illness pushed me over the edge. I began having mysterious episodes of extreme vertigo and painful inner ear pressure. I had to give up my job as a senior database marketing analyst along with my volunteer work. I spiraled downward, but I kept it to myself. I thought, if you were a better Christian, you could cope. Based on some misguided advice in an online support group, I began drinking to help quell my physical symptoms. The alcohol also numbed the feelings of failure and loneliness, so I started drinking more, and abusing pills, too. One day, I just decided I couldn't take it anymore. I wrote my family a letter and tried to tape it to my bedroom door, but I'd been drinking all day, and I was so emotionally out of it, I couldn't find any tape. I used a Band-Aid. My family and I went to therapy together, and it was very healing, but I still feel so much guilt about what I put my children through. I just lost my mind. When I came to, at first I was angry that I was still alive. But a few hours later, a friend came by and hugged me and said, "I heard you were having a hard time." Even in my addled state, I could feel how loved I was. I spent 2 weeks in a facility getting psychiatric and substance abuse treatment, then did a 6-week outpatient program. When I got home, I pulled out some old journals to try to figure out how I'd fallen so far. I could see how the depression fed on itself. The worse I felt, the further I drew away from the people I loved and the spiritual practices that had always sustained me. There's a reason they call it spiritual practice. Every day I practice the things that help me feel better: prayer, meditation, gratitude, creativity. I wrote a book called Well that includes coping strategies. For my pen name, I used Alias in Town, an anagram of my name, because in every town there are those who live with hidden depression and addiction. I'm also speaking about mental health in churches. The sad surprise is the number of people who have told me they've had similar thoughts. When you're so depressed, you think you're alone, but you aren't. Today I can say, as one old hymn goes, even so, it is well. If you are having thoughts of suicide, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or text HOME, H-O-M-E in all caps, to 741-741, the crisis text line. Our next article by Monica Sean is titled, "The Viral Moms of TikTok Are Redefining What It Means to Be Cool." A woman stands over the stove in her kitchen wearing black spandex biker shorts and a fitted gray tank top, her hair in a top bun. Suddenly, she whips her head around, holding a frying pan in one hand with a tea towel thrown over her shoulder, and then she starts singing, "I ain't gonna be cooking all day, I ain't your mama. I ain't gonna do your laundry, I ain't your mama." If you're envisioning Jennifer Lopez, you're close. But this scene is actually from a video on the social media app TikTok, filmed set to Lopez's 2016 song, Ain't Your Mama. And instead of J-Lo, the clip stars Melanie Richards, a mom of two boys living in Southern California with her husband. After Richards lip-syncs her I ain't your mama declaration, the video cuts to her adorable son saying, "But you are my mama, Mom. You've got to stop listening to Jennifer Lopez," which only encourages Richards to start dancing. Since it was originally posted over a year ago, the 15-second sketch has racked up 3.9 million views, with almost 500,000 likes, the first TikTok to go mega viral for the Richards family, whose account at Malou and Two has now amassed over 1 million followers. The usage of Lopez's song for similar TikTok videos started with creator at Christian Olivares. Now, videos tagged with pound, but you are my mama mom, have collectively reached almost 1 million views. For an app generally associated with a younger demographic, the virality of content created by mothers might sound surprising at first, but the sheer number of viewers suggests that a new wave of online mom culture was long overdue. Of course, it didn't take a pandemic for TikTok to ascend. The app had 1.5 billion downloads by November 2019, according to analytics firm Sensor Tower. But certainly the fact that many Americans started spending more time at home boosted the platform's number of users. In the months of February and March 2020, TikTok became the most downloaded non-game app worldwide. And by April, the social media app had passed 2 billion downloads, with top stars raking in millions in advertising deals. Its surge in users has even attracted attention from tech giant Microsoft, who is currently in talks to buy TikTok's global operations. Now, even Hollywood moms, from Lopez to Mariah Carey, Reese Witherspoon, and Jessica Alba, have created accounts on the app. But the real delight is discovering the quote-unquote regular moms who are going viral on the app every day. While in recent years our society's often unrealistic expectations of mothers have been influenced by celebrities, Pinterest projects, mommy bloggers, and picture-perfect Instagram influencers, now, TikTok is ushering in a whole new wave of viral motherhood, no filters needed. And while TikTok certainly isn't the first platform to offer the mom community a refreshing or even satirical outlet on the internet, it has offered an easy way for users of any age to be themselves on social media. In other places, mom content is full of super perfect and crisp images of the beautiful life, says Kudzi Chikumbu, TikTok's director of creator community. But on TikTok, it's about real life and true connection, which is why I think people are starting to take notice. The highlight reel is gone and the real reel is here. You are celebrated for just being you. In a virtual universe where mothers have long been mommy shamed for any small misstep, TikTok has created a parallel reality where women can be unapologetic. Got super corny mom jokes, but your family doesn't think you're funny? Want to poke fun at your kid's favorite music? Going crazy in quarantine and need a creative outlet? The possibilities are endless. Brooke Erin Duffy, an associate professor at Cornell who studies the intersection of media, culture, and technology, says that one reason TikTok is particularly appealing for moms is the likelihood that most of your audience is not people you know in real life, the way it might be if you post your content on Facebook. They don't have the same expectations about how you should be treating your kids or how you should be acting at work, she says. It's a way to project a more authentic version of yourself. Certainly, TikTok isn't utopia, and as it continues to grow, it's faced increased scrutiny around the app's security, what types of people get to go viral, and which creators get credit for their work. Not to mention, the platform has also seen increased competition from rival apps like Instagram, Triller, Byte, and more. It's possible that the runaway hit video app's future is hanging in the balance. Just as quickly as virality can come and go, the platform can disappear equally as fast. But whether it's on TikTok or another platform someday, the most important offering the app has brought to the internet is the reminder that social media can make the stress of the real-world concerns seem far, far away, even if it's just for 60 seconds. So we talked to four mothers with popular accounts on the app about what it's like being a viral, cool mom and how to lean into what brings you joy. Ashley Rose Reeves. Ashley Reeves' TikTok life can easily be divided into two periods. Before, former NSYNC boy bander Lance Bass commented on one of her videos, and after. After a video of her dancing to Bye 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 started going viral on the app, it caught Bass's eye, an exciting moment for the mom of four who was obsessed with the boy band as a kid. When she first downloaded TikTok in November 2019, she had about 100 followers. At first, I definitely felt like an old hag, the Utah native says. But instead of trying to dance to songs she didn't know that she saw going viral by the younger set, Reeves decided to just focus on what she loved, NSYNC's Bye 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 choreography, which she spent hours practicing as a kid in the 90s. Apparently, TikTok users loved it too. To date, the video has almost 300,000 views. Lance Bass left a clapping hands emoji, and Reeves' account gained 5,000 followers within a week. I think TikTok gives people permission to act silly, Reeves says. A lot of people have that in us. How often do you just want to dance around and have fun, but you don't really have an excuse? Now she even gets her husband, a high school principal, in on the fun, and she says the app has helped her marriage. I feel like sometimes between your mortgage payment and the children and all the schedules, it's just an excuse to be silly, Reeves says. We laugh hysterically when we make the videos, even when my husband takes it really seriously. He'll be like, Ashley, you're supposed to do this and this, so I get a crack out of it. It's been a really fun thing for us to do together. Despite her now 330,000 followers on the app, Reeves isn't trying to fit in with the kids. Teenagers are totally cool. There's nothing wrong with them. That's just not who I'm interested in hanging out with on TikTok. I want to hang out with people my age, other mothers. Whether it's working moms or stay-at-home moms, I don't even care. I just like being able to connect with people my age. Chriselle Lim. If you ever dreamed about being adopted by a rich mom with nice things, you can live out that luxurious fantasy by following Chriselle Lim's TikTok. The 35-year-old mother of two worked for over a decade in the world of fashion, which means that now her enviable closet full of trendy designer goods and videos of her lifestyle are perfect content. Somebody on Twitter posted a video of mine from TikTok saying, "I don't know who this rich mom is, but look at her wardrobe." It went mega viral, recalls Lim. And now these kids on TikTok know me as your rich mom. I kind of have this alter ego. I'll get into character, which isn't really me, but it is kind of me. Lim's TikTok account, which now has over 2 million followers since she started in December 2019, has elevated her cool mom street cred with teenagers she doesn't even know. At my local Starbucks, I can barely go in without high schoolers coming up to me, she says. It definitely does make me feel a little younger and hipper. She also recalls that she was once out with her husband and two young daughters when a group of teenage boys came up to them and asked, "Are you guys the TikTok family?" The teen demographic's fascination with her family and her rich mom persona is a little jarring, but it's also inspired Lim, who tries to use this cool credibility she's amassed on the platform to create teachable moments, and not just about fashion. The social media influencer, who got her start making videos on YouTube while bored in college, says TikTok is where she feels able to express the fullest evolution of herself as a fashion blogger, businesswoman, and mom. "Me right now is just this person who is a little bit of everything, and sometimes people are like, 'You need to find your niche. You need to find your voice,'" Lim says. "But this is my voice. My voice is a little bit of everything." Ashley Soto. "I was just a bored stay-at-home mom and accidentally became a popular creator," says Ashley Soto. Popular is putting it lightly. Soto has a whopping 7.5 million followers on TikTok. Born and raised in Texas, the mom of three describes herself as a really goofy person who channeled that into a passion for making funny comedies and videos that moms can relate to. Now Soto, who had her first daughter at 17, finds that both kids and moms on TikTok relate to her videos. "I feel like that's the biggest part of my growth, the relatable content. Kids can come on and be like, 'Oh, my mom does that.' And moms can be like, 'My kid totally does that.'" Like Chriselle, her viral comedy-focused videos have turned Ashley into a local celebrity of sorts. "The kids at my daughter's school think I'm like the coolest mom ever. A lot of kids will run up to us in public." But Soto isn't really chasing celebrity in its traditional sense, still identifying as the bored stay-at-home mom that she was pre-TikTok, albeit with the extra cool factor that 7 million followers affords her. She wants that sense of freedom for other regular moms like her. "I feel like all moms, especially if you're a stay-at-home mom and you feel lonely, if they were to get on TikTok, it would open up a whole new world to them. You can have fun and put yourself out there. You know what I mean?" Even if creating videos isn't your thing or you don't have time, Soto still recommends TikTok as a useful tool for mothers, just to see what the kids are doing. Melanie Richards. Without TikTok, Melanie Richards says, I would have no clue what the heck a, hold on, what was that word? A boomer is. I would not know what the kids meant when they said, okay, boomer. She's referring to the controversial meme Generation Z is often used to make fun of the baby boomer generation. Now I feel cool because I understand the lingo of what my kids are saying. Parenting two boys, 7th grader Isaiah and 8th grader Jason, with her husband Lewis, certainly provides enough fodder for an entertaining TikTok account full of boy mom adventures, hilarious sketches with the whole family, and quality time with her husband. I sing all day long in the house. I joke around. In all honesty, that is me to my core. My family is my absolute everything. Richard's videos and the over 1.1 million followers have definitely elevated her cool mom status. When I go to a parent-teacher conference, sometimes there are kids that literally are like, Miss Richards, please follow me back. I kid you not. But despite the extra attention, Richards makes it clear that the app is purely an extracurricular for her and the boys. I'm still a mom at heart. One kid goes to bed at 8:30, my other one goes to bed at 9, she explains. I'm mom mode first, and although we have a great following, to me, your schoolwork and everything else will come first. And even despite having brand deals with major American companies, Melanie and her husband both work day jobs. TikTok has been very profitable for our family, and I'm sure for some people, they could probably quit their job and just do advertising. But that's not necessarily my main focus with doing it, Richard says. I want my boys to know that this is something we do for fun. Our next article by Jonathan Borg is titled, I'm a grown man who sleeps with stuffed animals, and that's normal. My relationship with Kit and Bun isn't taken very seriously. Get that thing away from me, a close friend always says whenever I bounce either of their pint-sized fluffy bodies in her direction. It's so weird that you do this, especially when you make them talk. But is it weird? I'm a 27-year-old man who sleeps with his two favorite stuffed animals, and I'm not embarrassed to say so. For about 4 years, Kit and Bun have grown closer to me than certain relatives I'd grown at the sight of ever will. They cuddle with me in bed every night. They've squeezed into my carry-on for over a dozen trips, earning frequent flyer status. And whenever I decide to take on the role of ventriloquist, these two indeed tend to speak up around loved ones, with distinct catchphrases, precise inflection, and sometimes a little bit of sass. What began as a joke quickly snowballed into two lifelong friendships. Kit, an adorable black and white plush puppy with an innocent smile, was gifted to me as a sweet gesture from a boyfriend. The first time I saw her, my face lit up. She brought me an immediate sense of childlike joy. Months later, said boyfriend surprised me with Bun, a squishy mouse with glasses as round as my own. I quickly became enamored with Kit and Bun because, without fail, they always provided what humans could not, instant comfort. I'm aware that admitting I not only sleep with, but also speak to and assign voices for my stuffed animals might make me sound immature, or maybe even a weirdo with seriously suppressed issues. However, I'm not alone. A 2018 study conducted by OnePoll and Life Storage reportedly found that 4 in 10 adults, or 43%, still engage with a stuffed animal. And surprisingly, 84% of men own at least one, compared to the 77% of women who do. And in 2017, Best Mattress Brand polled over 2,000 Americans and learned that millennials, aka my generation, are the largest group to still sleep with stuffed animals, and that only 29% of people would feel bothered if their partner cuddled with their own versions of Kit and Bun. Polls aside, the camaraderie that my two inanimate objects, or friends as I prefer calling them, provide also seems to be supported by science. As the Chicago Tribune points out, British psychologist and pediatrician Donald Winnicott coined the term transitional object to describe the items we easily grow attached to. Stuffed animals, special blankets, or old pieces of clothing, for instance. Apparently, they help us feel less stressed after separation of any kind. And while this is most common with infants and toddlers, multiple studies have shown that adults can benefit from touching something comforting, especially those with low self-esteem. Admittedly, I had a rather emotionally turbulent childhood. Sorry, Mom and Dad. That led to the development of psychological trauma in my adulthood. As a kid, my rotating mix of Beanie Babies helped me get through some stressors like my mother's cancer diagnosis or, not quite as scary, the angst that came with meeting new classmates on the first day of school. My transitional objects have always made me feel less isolated, and so it makes sense that years later, my relationship with Kit and Bun doubles as a coping mechanism for anxiety. But I believe you don't need some convoluted, science-backed reason to want to play with stuffed animals at any age. When I do choose to interact with Kit and Bun, it's not because I'm longing to get to the bottom of an emotion, the way I would during a session with my psychotherapist. It's simply because I'm looking to have fun. Because for a moment, I want to forget about real-life responsibilities. As a writer and storyteller, I've developed fully-fledged plot lines for Kit and Bun's lives. Kit is a precocious pre-K student with a passion for Madewell denim skirts and an affinity for doing what's right. Her mischievous sister Bun, however, is a huge flirt who isn't afraid of telling it like it is, and who's racked up major debt on her department store credit card. See, it's amusing, an escape. My friends are well aware of my stuffed animals' unique personalities, so much so that they've conditioned themselves into properly greeting Kit and Bun whenever they come over for movie night. And the dynamic duo became a key part of the relationship I have with the boyfriend who gifted them to me. After years of owning them, Kit and Bun would swoop in to interject during our arguments, acting as buffers to get us to push the conversation toward the better. We cared for them together with as much intensity as pet owners care for their actual animal friends. No matter how hard the going gets, Kit and Bun are always there to make me laugh. They also serve as soft, cotton-padded figurines I can literally cry on. As you'd expect, some of my loved ones raise their eyebrows at the sight of me interacting with them in my spare time. But the point of maintaining the friendship I've created with these two stuffed animals isn't to impress anyone. Instead, it's to make myself feel better, to get one step closer to living my ideal of a best life. So no, I'm not ashamed of considering Kit and Bun two of the closest friends in my life, and I don't plan to get rid of them or put a halt to the imaginary adventures I create for them each day. In fact, considering they were purchased from the kids department at H&M and plenty of their adorable lookalikes are available online, I'll end with an idea I've been pondering for a while. It may be time for my family to grow. Our next article is titled Lady Gaga's Mom, Cynthia Germanotta, on How Her Daughter Tries to Build a Kinder, Braver World. There are two things I've always known about my daughter Stephanie, who you may know as Lady Gaga, that she would be a performer and that she had a compassionate heart. Both her talent and her heart shaped her purpose from an early age. Even as a kindergartner, if she saw someone crying, she'd want to console them. She was also always unique with her own personal style and passion in life. Not everyone saw that difference as special, though, and when she was in middle school, her classmates began to bully her. This once joyous young girl grew depressed and anxious. She didn't understand what was happening to her, and her dad and I didn't understand the warning signs of that anxiety and depression. I didn't realize everything she was going through at the time, and she was too embarrassed to share it. But I know the trauma of those encounters stays with her to this day. When Stephanie began touring and talking with fans, they told her about so many similar experiences. She was 22, connecting with other young people who had been silently hurting, and realized that sharing her story could give others hope, and invited them to share their own. Those connections became a movement, which led to our co-creating Born This Way Foundation in 2012. Our mission is to build a kinder and braver world and to inspire young people to focus on their mental wellness, with initiatives like Channel Kindness, a platform for sharing stories of compassion and resilience, or Teen Mental Health First Aid, which teaches how to recognize and respond to peers who might be in crisis. About half of mental health issues develop before age 14, as our family experienced firsthand. In a society where these challenges are still stigmatized, Stephanie envisions a world where youth are better prepared than she was to deal with them. Stephanie has been very candid about both her challenges and triumphs. As a parent, I find it extremely difficult to hear about her suffering, but I also deeply admire her vulnerability and courage. I come from a generation that didn't talk about struggles very openly. Our parents grew up in a time of true grit where you just bucked up and got on with things. But the more I've listened to Stephanie and her sister Natalie, the more I've learned about the healing power of sharing your story and the transformative impact of kindness to others and to yourself. It's been a privilege to connect with this community of young people who want to help each other and heal. Along with my daughters, they've inspired me to become a better mother and a better leader, and I found my own purpose in the world. The O Quiz, a round of 20 questions with Lady Gaga. When do you feel most alive? When I'm in the presence of big nature, like the ocean or mountains. The internet can amplify my sense of my own value. Nature reminds me that I'm small and that I'm no more valuable than anyone else. What's the one thing in life you're so happy you did? I always manage to believe in myself. There's freedom in knowing deep down that I'm good enough and that shame is just a symptom of life's great obstacles. Who's the one person who changed your life? My grandmother. After I was raped, I cried on her couch for days. Eventually, she turned on MTV and told me to look up. A female artist was performing. My grandmother said, "I'll let you cry the rest of the day, but then tomorrow you're going to go back out and make a real change in this world. No more tears tomorrow." What makes you cry now? Telling myself old stories that don't serve me. What's your favorite place on earth? My home, and I love being in my family's home when we're all together. Who's one of your heroes? My sister. I love her heart, her mind, her nature, which is abundantly good and pure. Her ability to laugh during hard times is exceptional. We can both be crying and all of a sudden she'll tell a joke. What's most important for your mental health? Dialectical behavior therapy. It's a skills-based treatment method that keeps my psyche and body focused and balances my emotional and rational mind. I have fibromyalgia, and although living with chronic physical pain is difficult, I've radically accepted that while I cannot think my way out of this problem, I can behave my way out of it with stress tolerance skills and routines. If you could send a note to yourself in 2030, what would it say? I love you. What's one thing you were wrong about? Once I felt so depressed, I thought it was a good idea to give up. That's the worst thing you can do. I wish I'd just asked for help, but I forgive myself. What would you love to invent? A way that we could actively send kindness to people around the world all the time. It wouldn't be filled with competition or virtue signaling, just a simple daily message. When in your life have you needed courage? Always. I started my life with so much and then lost a lot of it, but I dug deep in the trenches of my heart to excavate it like a friendly old fossil. It's within all of us. We just have to be willing to do the hard work to find it, and then we need to figure out what to do with it. The real triumph is using our courage to help others. What's your worst habit? Looking in the rearview mirror of the metaphorical vehicle that is life. It's a loop I don't need. My mother gives me sage advice. She says it's okay to glance back, but don't stare. If you could choose any magical power, what would it be? To bring peace to the world instantly. What do you think about on long drives or flights? Are we there yet? What is your most prized possession? My voice. If you were creating a time capsule to be opened in 100 years, what would you put inside? Letters from my fans, my music, and a story about the history of my Italian-American family. How do you define soulmate? Someone who would never leave you behind if you were lost, and I think the feeling must be mutual. I believe you can have many soulmates, and they don't necessarily have to be lovers. What's one thing you'd change about yourself? Sometimes I wish I were more independent and less afraid of paparazzi and being in public. What's the greatest gift we can give each other? Kindness. What's the greatest gift we can give ourselves? Kindness. Our next article is titled Cecil Williams on His Lifelong Career as a Civil Rights Photographer, interviewed by DeJane Lawrence. Cecil J. Williams is a publisher, an author, and a well-known civil rights photographer. He has worked as a photographer for publications such as Jet Magazine, the newspaper The Afro-American, and the Pittsburgh Courier. He was also a stringer for the Associated Press. He is the author of several books, among them Unforgettable, Orangeburg 1968, and Freedom and Justice. His work can be found in over 130 publications, 17 newspapers, 11 television documentaries, and in several museums and galleries across the country. He operates the Cecil Williams Civil Rights Museum in Orangeburg, South Carolina. Now begins the interview. What is your earliest memory? My earliest memory would be at my house on Quick Street here in Orangeburg. When I was growing up and playing out in the backyard of my home, there was a sugarcane growth. I remember going back there and playing Tarzan. How would you describe your childhood? I had a happy childhood, but of course segregation prevailed in all aspects of my life. The library was segregated, the schools were segregated, the playground facilities were segregated. Growing up in that kind of atmosphere made me very aware that I was living in a part of the United States that was different from what I would expect, being a citizen of the United States. What invention from your lifetime are you most amazed by? I'm amazed by the very recent invention, the cell phone. I appreciate the ingenuity behind Steve Jobs and the development of, first of all, the Macintosh computer and then the smartphone, because you really have a computer in your pocket. If you could go back to any age, what would it be and why? I would go back to age 21, because if I could go back to the age 21 and know everything that I know now, there would be investments I would make. I believe that I was born at the most ideal time to witness mankind achieving a certain degree of triumph over racism. And if I were that age, I would certainly be able to make better decisions in life. Not only did you live it, but you recorded it through your photography. What events led you to become a photographer? I started in photography at 9 years old. My brother, who usually used the camera, passed the camera on to me. I grew more than just an ordinary attachment to that device. I was obsessed by the capacity of that little camera to capture something and freeze that moment in time. It also enabled me, at that early age, to be able to go to Edisto Gardens and take pictures of people who would pay me a dollar. $1 then is probably $5 now. That was a sizable amount for a 9-10-year-old person. Was there a person or event that changed or impacted the course of your life? Each person that came into my life in some kind of way, they were very important and they had a great impact. Starting with my teachers and the influence they had. My parents had a great influence on my values. They were supportive in seeing that I had the best kind of education, that I had sufficient food to sustain me from one day to the other, clothing, paying for things, helping me to buy a car or riding in the car that they had. We all stand on the shoulders of so many others. Have you ever met any prominent people? I have probably photographed anyone that you could name, whether they are in sports, entertainment, motion pictures, actors, actresses, such as Muhammad Ali, even Joe Louis, Sugar Ray Robinson, in baseball, Jackie Robinson, in tennis, Arthur Ashe, in motion pictures, Cicely Tyson and Lena Horne. If you can name any president of the United States, I have photographed them, except Trump. What was your inspiration in creating the Cecil Williams Civil Rights Museum? The creation of my museum was not an overnight obsession. I believe that if you want to know where you're going, you also have to know where you've come from. Our history and all the freedom, the justice, the humanity, and all the good things that we can enjoy today were because people engaged in the civil rights movement, where we as people of color gained freedoms that impact us today. So much emphasis and credit must be given to the people that helped to carve that path. What are your thoughts about the Black Lives Matter movement and police brutality among the African American community? Let me say that we cannot do without the great courage and the heroism on the part of our police and law enforcement systems of the United States. We would not want to live in an area or community or in a state or county or city in this United States without law enforcement. But there have been cases of police brutality on the part of some untrained or ill-trained officers. In the case of George Floyd, they suspected that a counterfeit bill was passed. The crime committed was not worth the punishment. So that police officer was the jury and judge and committed him to death for such a small infraction. Though times have changed from when you were younger, do you still see slivers of the world you knew growing up? There was similarity to the marches and demonstrations, the protests all over this world. The people, in spite of the COVID restrictions, came out in the street to address those concerns of police brutality. However, I want to place some of the blame on our political people, people who have high positions in the federal, state, county, and city governments of America. I have yet to hear any of them in all the conversations on television, reading the newspaper, for them to address the high rate of incarceration we have, especially among African Americans. There's a whole institution of prisons that's been created to put people of color in prison for minor infractions of the law. The system needs drastic corrections so that we can go forward with treating every person with respect. In all your years of living, what is the most important thing you have learned about yourself? One of the lessons that I've learned in life is the power of our Maker in our lives, and that we should be God-fearing. And of course, give more credit to God and religion in our everyday lives so that we can take on the challenges we face today. And then the family unit, the lessons you learned in the family and the power of the family. And then the teachers, when it comes down to education, they were so very important. My education at Claflin, in fact, is without parallel. I don't believe that I could have gone any place in the entire world and gotten a better education than the education I received at Claflin University. Looking back, are you happy with the life you've lived? Any regrets? Anything you would change? I am very fortunate to have lived the life that I have lived. I believe that I could not ask for very much more. To have been in a position of being brought up in an environment where there were so many challenges, but we were able to overcome those challenges. I feel very blessed and fortunate to have lived the life that I have lived. And my contribution is to provide a museum like the one I have created, so that we might be able to still look at the images of yesterday, so that we can carve out a better present and a better future. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is Fall Quotes That'll Make You Long for Autumn. The heat of autumn is different from the heat of summer. One ripens apples, the other turns them to cider. Jane Hirschfeld, from her poem The Heat of Autumn. What is sometimes called a tongue of flame, or an arm extended, burning, is only the long, red and orange branch of a green maple in early September. Grace Paley, from her poem Autumn. In her famous novel Anne of Green Gables, L.M. Montgomery wrote, "I'm so glad I live in a world where there are Octobers." I would rather sit on a pumpkin and have it all to myself than be crowded on a velvet cushion. Henry David Thoreau, from his book Walden. It looked like the world was covered in a cobbler crust of brown sugar and cinnamon. Sarah Addison Allen, from her book First Frost. No spring nor summer beauty hath such grace as I have seen in one autumnal face. John Donne, from his poem The Autumnal. I cannot endure to waste anything so precious as autumnal sunshine by staying in the house. Nathaniel Hawthorne, from the American Notebooks. In her poem Fall Leaves Fall, Emily Bronte wrote, "Every leaf speaks bliss to me, fluttering from the autumn tree." Life starts all over again when it gets crisp in the fall. F. Scott Fitzgerald from The Great Gatsby. Aprils have never meant much to me. Autumn seemed that season of beginning, spring. Truman Capote from Breakfast at Tiffany's. Winter is an etching, spring a watercolor, summer an oil painting, and autumn a mosaic of them all. Stanley Horowitz from a 1983 Reader's Digest poem. There is a time in the last few days of summer when the ripeness of autumn fills the air and time is quiet and mellow. Rudolfo Anaya from his novel Bless Me Ultima. Now autumn's fire burns slowly along the woods, and day by day the dead leaves fall and melt. William Allingham from his book Day and Night Songs. I love the splendor of thy sunset skies, the gorgeous hues that tinge each falling leaf, lovely as beauty's cheek, as woman's love too brief. William Cullen Bryant from his poem Indian Summer. Delicious autumn, my very soul is wedded to it, and if I were a bird, I would fly about the earth seeking the successive autumns. George Eliot, in a letter he wrote to a Miss Lewis in 1841. Autumn is the hardest season. The leaves are all falling, and they're falling like they're falling in love with the ground. Andrea Gibson, in her song, Photograph. Even if something is left undone, everyone must take time to sit still and watch the leaves turn. Elizabeth Lawrence from her book, A Southern Garden. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.